Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Brian J. Jones, who's out with his latest biography, Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, and The Making of an American Imagination. He's previously written biographies of Jim Henson and George Lucas. It's almost like he follows the soundtrack of my childhood, but some people may not have been in The Muppets and Sesame Street, and other people may not be into Star Wars. Everyone has certainly read a Dr. Seuss book. Brian, great name, by the way. So many of us remember Dr. Seuss books from our youth. What type of childhood did Ted Geisel have without Dr. Seuss?
Ted Geisel actually had a very happy childhood. He was born in 1904, so a long time ago now. But, you know, did the things that kids do. He played with his toy soldiers on the front porch of his house, and he had a three-legged bulldog that toddled around after him. And his parents were actually brewers. He was from a very successful brewing family in Springfield, Massachusetts, who ended up losing everything when Prohibition came along. So he sort of had the ups and downs of that and remembered living with that as well. It happened when he was getting ready to go off to college, but, you know, saw his family's fortunes decline with that, but rose back again because his father was a successful public servant and his grandfather invested very well. But, you know, a fairly normal childhood.
He became involved in a school newspaper in high school. What was his role there?
He would write really bad one-liners in papers, and he would write parodies of poems. He wrote a parody of Walt Whitman's "O Captain, My Captain." So even at that age, he was sort of learning his way around verse and rhyme and being silly. And he already had a knack for, you know, coming up with sort of silly names and things like that. So it's he's already sort of becoming Dr. Seuss even when he's in high school.
I was surprised to learn from reading your book how well educated he was. Ivy League and then Oxford, right?
Yeah, I mean, well-educated is a relative term when it comes to him, because he definitely went to the great schools. He was a very sort of middling student at Dartmouth, and when he got to Oxford, he did very little studying. He was much more interested in wooing the woman who became his wife and sort of traveling around, but never actually got his Ph.D. He often said that he took the name Doctor out of deference to his father, who had paid for the Ph.D. that he never got.
Well, let's talk about his first wife, Helen. Where did they meet?
They met at Oxford. They were in class together, and typical of Dr. Seuss that he was doing anything but taking notes, and he had this big notebook, which I actually got to see and touch, that he was taking notes in but mostly doodling in. And she was watching him doodle and was fascinated by his art. And she was the one who told him, even when he got done at Oxford, you know, you should make a living drawing. She saw the potential in him early on and, you know, knew that he wasn't ever going to be an English teacher. She actually got her master's degree and ended up teaching English for a while in the United States, but knew that that wasn't his destiny and really encouraged him to get into drawing cartoons and supported him before they got married, and then once got married and lived in New York, also supported him, but was really the one who encouraged him. It became sort of his best editor as he started writing his Dr. Seuss books.
Lots of careers happen just by chance, and this happened to Dr. Seuss, right?
It sure did, yeah, in a number of ways. So his first book, And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, was actually not really written because, you know, Dr. Seuss felt compelled to tell great stories for children. He was a very successful advertising man by this point in his career. He was in his early 30s, and he had a very successful ad campaign for Bug Killer that he had done for Standard Oil, for the Standard Motor Company, or Standard Oil, and he also did Motor Oil, and he had these huge campaigns, but he was prohibited from doing a lot of things by his contract, except he could do kids' books. So he wrote And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, mainly because there was money on the table more than anything else. But once he wrote and drew that book, he had a heck of a time finding anyone to publish it. And the story varies. You have to sort of, you know, watch the way he tells his own story from time to time. But the book was rejected countless times. You know, 27 seems to be the number everyone's agreed on. And he tells the story about walking down the streets of New York, getting ready to take the book home and burn it, when he meets an old friend of his from Dartmouth who says, "Hey, I work for Vanguard Publishing in children's division, and, you know, bring it upstairs and let's see if we want it." And so he says, "Had I been walking down the other side of the street, I might be in the dry cleaning business today."
What was the lay of the land like in American literature for children's books like this, or was he a complete paradigm shift?
He was a paradigm shift in the sense that he was sort of leading the way. There were a number of good books that were beginning to come out, a number that were sort of character-driven. You know, Ferdinand the Bull came out right around that time, and he actually knew Monroe Leaf during World War II, who wrote that book. The Eloise books were coming out now. Curious George was starting to come out. So you were getting these sort of outliers that were more, you know, not quite so generic, what Dr. Seuss always sort of derisively called bunny books. You know, it was books that actually had a central character, that were a little funnier, had a little more personality, and reflected a little more of the personality of the author. But he was clearly leading the charge with his books. So he was on the leading edge of sort of this nascent movement that was coming up, but really changed the landscape with Cat in the Hat when he got into that book and embraced the restrictive reading lists of, you know, the Dick and Jane reading primers, and wrote Cat in the Hat using just that restrictive list of words. That changed everything for children's literature and for publishing.
You cover, obviously, the full life, so you cover both his public triumphs and his personal tragedies. His sisters died very young. How did that affect him?
Well, he had one sister who died very young of, I think, just got pneumonia, and he remembered hearing the sounds of her coughing in the house even as a kid, and he was terrified after she died. This was in their house in Springfield. They had put her little coffin in the front room, and he was constantly sort of spooked by that front room, because that had been where his one sister's body had been. Later on, his other sister, Margaret, she died probably of complications due to alcoholism. And, you know, when you're children of brewers, that's a really, really tough place to go. Really adored her, and they really got along really well, and she was sort of his protector because she was a little bit older than he was. You know, I think he felt that he had neglected her at one point in her life. She thought she was a little rough to deal with, as she was undergoing agoraphobia and things like this, but really took care of her daughter for a number of years, her daughter Peggy. She lived with him in California, and so, you know, I think he felt a sense of responsibility for his sister Peggy, for his sister Margaret, and really took care of his own niece.
I learned so many things I didn't know about him in this book, and I guess that's the point of it, but he had a Hollywood career. What was he doing out there?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The Hollywood career very nearly derailed him. Had his Hollywood career not sort of tanked, we may not have ever gotten Cat in the Hat, because when he was in the Army, he worked under Frank Capra. Frank Capra was his commanding officer, and they were doing a lot of, you know, they did the Private Snafu cartoons, and they were doing a lot of what we would consider propaganda films and how-to films. And a lot of the films that he wrote, even during his time in the Army, ended up being adapted into documentary films that won Oscars. So he had a pretty good track record in the mid to late 40s with, you know, scripts he had written that had been turned into documentary features that had won the Academy Award. He wrote the script. He wrote the story that ended up being adapted into Gerald McBoing Boing, also wins an Academy Award. So he had this sort of hot streak. And so he'd been hired to touch up a number of scripts, which he didn't enjoy because it became, you know, writing by committee, which he didn't like. He finally ends up getting an offer to write this film called The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, which just turns into agony and a horrible experience for him. The movie does get made. If you can find it, watch it. It's very interesting. It looks like a Dr. Seuss movie. But it was just such a terrible experience for him that he eventually decided he was much happier just working for himself and not for, you know, the suits upstairs that were going to mark up his scripts and send it back down with things he couldn't read or understand on them. But again, very nearly derailed his career. He was very attracted by the idea of the sort of quick money that Hollywood would provide him to write or touch up these scripts.
And then I didn't know anything about his political cartoons. Those things, I mean, we saw it with the New York Times a couple weeks ago. His cartoons would be excoriated today.
Some of them are, yeah. Some of them are very progressive, even by today's standards. You know, he had Charles Lindbergh's number very early on for American isolationism, and, you know, it saw that the danger of Hitler and Nazism and Mussolini. So he called, you know, he recognized the problems with a lot of these guys very early on, and it kept saying, you know, we have to prepare for war, which was not a popular thing to do back at the time. He has some cartoons that are a little problematic. Probably the most problematic one he has is what they call the fifth column one, where he was living in La Jolla, California, and really sort of bought into the argument that the government was making that, you know, Japanese Americans should probably be put in internment camps right now. Terrible, terrible policy, which he fell for, and he really should have known better because he was a German American during World War One and had scars still, probably literal scars, of remembering having the kids throwing coal at him saying kill the Kaiser during World War One because he had a German last name. They were, you know, blaming him and trying to beat him up because we were fighting Germany. He really should have known better. That's the one that's a really bad look for him.
All right, the book is Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, and the Making of an American Imagination by Brian J. Jones. It's available now wherever your books are sold. Brian, just a great look at this life. We barely scratched the surface of it with this interview, but thanks for joining us.
Sure, what a pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Christmas.